All right, so we are back. We are back. Welcome back to Evil Thespian podcast. I am here with the cast of The Pool, a new play by Kara Gordon. I'm going to go across the board of who we have here with us today. So first we have Lauren Aguglielmo. We have Elida Rose Delaney, and we have Violet Savage with us today. Everyone, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Hi.
Hi. Cool. How's everyone doing today? It's Saturday.
A little slow today, honestly.
Okay.
Feeling the rainy energy still, I think.
Yeah. It's
Yeah,
been
it's
a
been
rain.
raining.
It's been a rainy summer.
New York's gotten a lot of rainfall. I feel like it's been raining every day for the past like 2 weeks, and all the flooding happened yesterday, which was very eventful in New York City and Brooklyn, to be underwater.
Just, sleepy, snuggles with the cat, That's all the things I want to be doing, but
Are all of you guys located in Brooklyn?
I'm in Harlem.
Harlem, cool.
I'm in Dallas.
Where are you?
I'm kind of in West Village
Okay.
area. I live with my parents here.
Love that. Love that.
I'm in Crown Heights in Brooklyn.
Cool. Excellent. And how long have all of you guys been in New York?
I moved to New York in 2015, actually. I feel like when I say that now, I'm like, oh my gosh, that was so long ago. But I moved in 2015, and I in tw when the pandemic happened, I actually moved back to my mom's house. She's in Massachusetts. That's where I was raised. And I actually spent a year living with her, which was like a really lovely thing to be able to go back and live with my mom. I mean, when would I have done that? You know, I was in my late 20s and I got to go back and like spend a year with my mom, which was actually really nice. And then I moved back here when things started opening back up. I came back.
Cool. Excellent.
I am from New York, which I don't know is very common. I just feel like I don't meet a lot of native New Yorkers, but I grew up partly in Carroll Gardens in Brooklyn. And then, long story short, my family wanted grass. And so we moved out to the suburbs in Long Island. And but we all were just still commuting back and forth into the city. I was commuting for dance, my brother was commuting for school, my dad was commuting for work. So and then as soon as I could, I always felt like Brooklyn was my real home. And found my way back here. So,
Oh, excellent.
As rare as a native New Yorker is, ironically, I'm also one. And yeah, I pretty much have not left really. I went to Bard for college, which is really only about 2 hours out of the city. So I was near grass for 4 years, but coming back all the time. And yeah, moved back here as soon as I graduated.
Cool. That's awesome. I was wondering, I mean, how would you all like identify yourselves as, because I'm really interested in this like concept of identifying by your vocation or your craft. Just out of curiosity, like what has all of your relationship to acting been like? Would you all do all like primarily come from a performance oriented background, or kind of what is that like for all of you?
I identify probably primarily as an actor. I always feel like I have a tendency to minimize it though in front of people. I always say, I'm an actor, but I work in restaurants or something like that. And I'm trying to get out of the habit of that. But yes, my performance experience is pretty much exclusively acting. I've done a little bit of singing in my life, but not much. And I'm really not a very skilled dancer, but it's a beautiful art form I wish I could do. So I always loved acting mostly as an after school hobby, probably. When I got to college, I didn't want to major in it because I, in my brain, was like, there's something more practical I can be doing. But once I got there, the only classes I wanted to take and felt really engaged in were theater classes. So I majored in it and then came here, kept taking classes, and have been doing that ever since. So yeah, I would say I'm primarily an actor in terms of performance background.
I have always, yeah, I've always said that I'm an actor since I was probably 12 or 13. That's when I started auditioning for independent films and web series when those were a thing in the Boston area. And I just knew that it was just something I wanted to do. It was really the only thing that I was like truly, really interested in. And in high school, I knew that I wanted to go to college. I knew I wanted to major in acting. But there was always this little thing like nagging at me, should I just move to LA and just like start my career? Which I'm very happy that I didn't do that. I went to DePaul University in Chicago. I went to the theater school there. And I spent 4 years. And they were huge for me. I didn't really have that theater foundation because I, again, was coming from mostly like on-screen work. It's so funny. In high school, like my like weekend job was like doing this this web series in Natick, Massachusetts, and that was kind of my first, you know, interaction with the work was on screen. So then going to college for theater, I mean, it just opened up the world so much to me. And I even feel like theater now is more of the foundation, more of the home for me. And it's probably because of that concentrated, you know, work that I spent at my time at DePaul. But when I graduated, I really started exploring, okay, well, what else can I do in addition to being the performer? I had all these like ideas, and I was interested in writing and producing. I have yet to direct, but it's something that I hope to do in the future. So I usually call myself like multi-hyphenated or creator, which I know that those are like buzzwords right now that like, I mean, I, you know, when I've like met with agencies or managers, they're like, oh, well, are you multi-hyphenated? And I'm like, yeah. Dang, it's a thing. Now. It's
that's like, interesting. Yeah, that like, people say that on the other end.
Yeah, totally. So yeah, so I mean, I wrote and produced a short film that we had a festival run that was in 2020, I believe. And I hope to do more work with writing and producing and directing. I mean, even recently I've been like, oh, I would love to direct a play. So hopefully that's what's coming in the future for me, if I can get the confidence up to do that. But I think performers really like, I think performers can do a lot of different things. I think that they should give themselves more credit. I think that they come from a place where they're feeling so much and witnessing so much at the same time. And I think we all, it's huge for directors and producers and writers to do what they do, and their craft is, you know, incredible. And I'm not saying that anyone can do it, but I do think that performers are witnessing and experiencing. And if they would like to try that, I think that they should have the confidence to do so, because they might know more than they think they do.
I love that. I love, mm-hmm. I resonate with what you said, Lauren. And also I think you should just go for it. So I was listening to everyone's stories, I was trying to like figure out how to summarize mine, because I didn't always act. I'd been doing ballet since I was 2 and was really fiercely pursuing that with my entire family's support, and did do that up until a period of time. And I was fortunate to retire on my own terms. It wasn't due to injury, but I truly just fell out of love with the art form. I was raised my parents took me to the movies, my parents took me to the opera, they took me to the theater. And part of me was always like, I wonder what it's like to speak. Because I speak through my body, and the dance world has changed now, because actually now dancers will sometimes talk on stage, depending on the choreographer. But yeah, so I was always curious about that. And a little shy and a little trepidatious about it. And my senior year, I was studying at Marymount Manhattan. I was a dance major, and I was a little bit of a rebel my senior year, in the sense that, you know, the teachers are like, you know, you're allowed a certain amount of days to go out and audition. And I was like, I'm gonna go out and audition for everything and anything. And if I have to miss class, I'll miss class, because ultimately, like, this place is not forever. I'm living in X amount of months, and I wanna be able to try and solidify something for myself. And I got into a small dance company, and I danced with them for a bit. But then I also did some plays here and there. I still was dancing because that felt safe and familiar. And then over time, I was just like, this is so painful. I have other interests. Like, now I interned at a St. Anne's Warehouse in Dumbo. And I was like, wow, I'm really interested in producing. And wow, I'm really interested in architecture. And I just kind of spiraled into just being overall like, into, I call myself a space shaper, and just being interested in cultivating communities, curating environments and experiences a la theater and film, but also sometimes being that medium myself. So I kind of just made a transition, and it was actually very easy for me, in the sense of theater made the most sense. I was very comfortable on stage. And I just recently started going back to take dance classes, but I don't really that's like a whole other life. Like, I really feel like I've moved on from that, and I love the theater, and I'm a kind of a secret opera nerd as well, but can't sing like that. But yeah, I don't know, I think I'm generally creative, and it depends on the project or the process. There's been many times where I've produced and was not on stage or not in front of the camera, and I'm okay with that. It just depends. So yeah, that's sort of my journey in a nutshell, I guess.
I love that. Mm. Well, with that said, I mean, coming from all of your backgrounds, how did... since we're here to talk about the pool, how did you all get involved in the pool? And what was your first impression when you first read the script?
I saw it on Instagram stories. I mean, that's just how it is these days. I don't know. My initial impression was, well, one, I'm always excited by you know, female writers slash directors, and it was unlike anything I've read in a long time, in the sense that it was really kind of like, how do I want to describe it? It was just something very different, and like I could tell has had many layers to it. And also I kind of was like, hey Kara, like who else is doing this? Because I like, for me also what gets me excited is the people involved, because I've seen Violet's work and I've seen Lauren's work, and we all float in kind of the same communities. And so I was like, oh my God, yay, like we're gonna have a chance to work together. Cool, like even better. So
excellent.
I also saw it on Instagram stories and reached out, and when I got the script, I loved it. It's really unique, really, really imaginative, which is really exciting, especially when you're working with such, you know, limited resources, very low budget. The type of world that is built is so specific and so interesting that I find it really fascinating and challenging to try to bring that to life, working with so little, but it's super exciting. And I just particularly really resonated with the character Angel, who I am playing. And yeah, when I read it, I just very much felt like she spoke to me in a very unique way, and I was just really, really excited by her and the story. There's so much happening, but it also reads incredibly clear, which is hard to do. It's hard to pack in so many layers and also have a very clear, concise story. So all of that was really exciting to me. And yeah, that's how I mm-hmm. join the team, and also the team is great.
So I was in a play with the theater company called Adult Film, Ryan Sarwanko's theater company, this past spring, and Kara came to see it, and when she put it up on Instagram, I had liked the casting notice, and she said, if you are willing and would like to audition for this, I think that there's a role in here for you. And so I said, yeah, sure, send me the script. And yeah, I was really interested by the script. I love, especially in theater, when, you know, the environment is one space for the whole mm-hmm. time. I think it really forces whoever is in that environment to confront who they are and who they are to the other people. And I really liked that the environment in this case is a bunker. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a really interesting choice. And yeah, when I first read it, actually, I was like, what an interesting way of writing dialogue. It almost reminded me, and I don't know, she might, if she listens to this, she might laugh. It almost reminded me a little bit of Samuel Beckett.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very kind of abstract, but also straightforward mm-hmm. and quick pacing, and also room for there to be breath and space and long pauses. And I think these characters kind of really confronting their identity and their where they are in space and time. And yeah, so I was really interested by it. I honestly, after I read it the first time, I was like, wow, what is this? What mm-hmm. I was like, this is really interesting. I think I have an idea of what it is, but I could be so off. And then I went and I auditioned for it, and I asked her, I said, so where does this come from? Is this inspired by anything, based on anything? And she was like, no, it just comes from my mind. And I was like, great, awesome.
Yeah. What would you say this play is about in terms of the plot?
We are a family in a pool room of a bunker, and we are millionaires, and our father has brought us down here. It is in the 1970s. We are frozen in time, and our father, who we don't meet, but we talk about a lot, convinced us to come down here and live for eternity, and basically exist as immortals. And we are having a huge party. Every day is a party, really. And then we have a visitor from the outside, someone from our past, who comes in and asks us some hard questions, shakes some things up a bit, and kind of disturbs the status quo. And I am playing Bunny, and like I said, and I am Junior's sister. Our father is the big millionaire mogul who brought us down here. And Junior has an interesting relationship with the two other women that are in the bunker. He is married to Rosabelle and also has a relationship with Angel.
Yeah, I really agree with that sentiment, that like the Samuel Beckett thing, because when I read it, I was getting the sense that there is sort of this surreal element that really runs through the dialogue and the staging, and it makes it so very like multifaceted. And it's I also really like this kind of like timeless aspect of you know, playwriting, that, you know, there's been something that has occurred off stage, and the characters are talking about it. I like Kara's work, and I've been reading a lot of plays about death recently, and I think it's such a interesting topic to just like right out of the bat. It's such a heavy, weighty, controversial concept. Death is, I guess, you know, and anyone can answer this question, maybe in your own words, what does this play like really tackle in terms of the characters' relationships with death?
I'd say, in my experience of working on this, it's been a lot about the beauty of life doesn't quite exist without death in many ways. And I think that's a lot of my character's relationship to it. It's actually quite... I'm trying to find the word. The word peaceful is coming to mind a lot. You know, in her feelings towards death, I think that there's a sense of peace that she's looking for that she never has had in her life. And that's what death is for her. Yeah, so for me, I think it's really about embracing life and embracing the beauty of the world, and acknowledging that death is kind of critical in really being able to live.
It was good. It's a good question. I think for my character, Rosabelle, I think for her, it's, well, I think she comes to terms with death once she has some closure, a combination of closure with her relationships, her sexuality. And then it's like, it's kind of heart-wrenching, actually, less like me thinking about it, because once she actually like chooses or to live in her truth, she also wants to die. but yeah, I mean, I think that's her relationship to death. And, you know, but at the same time, I mean, she also has a line where she was just like, I love life. I came here because it's beautiful. And, you know, also mentions something about, you know, attaining youth, which I think is, I mean, as women and just societally is like, you know, it's something we grapple with all the time. But yeah, I mean, I guess that's how I would describe it in relation to my character. Mm-hmm. I think.
So I play Bunny, and she's like just the party girl of the group. She is sister to Junior, and our father is the one who convinced us to come down to the bunker and live forever. And I think Bunny, I think she was fiercely loyal to her father. And we've all been kind of exploring personally in our own characters, you know, how our father was able to convince us to come down here for eternity, and kind of how big of an influence he was on us, and what his word meant to all of us. He's a very powerful man. And I think under it all, I am absolutely terrified to die. I don't want to die. I've been sold. I've drank the Kool-Aid, for lack of a better phrase. I've been sold what this is, and I'm sticking to it. And I think I move through the world afraid of losing this reality. And I also think that, well, Kara and I have talked a lot about how I've been disappointed in my life. And I was disappointed by the way life was previous to coming down to the bunker. But we've created the life that we want, which is partying and drinking and games and getting to be together in the bodies that are frozen in time, where we feel and look our best and we are the stars of the party. And I don't want death to be just another disappointment to me. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm different in the group, in that death isn't the answer for me. It's sticking right here. This is where I feel like I belong. And this is for the rest of eternity.
The bunker thing is so interesting to me, because it does feel like that's a capsule where time doesn't exist. I've watched a couple of documentaries on like people's apocalypse bunkers, and it's, to me, I just could never imagine, because you don't have any concept of time. Everything is, you have like this control in this environment that you wouldn't necessarily have outside of this like hideaway space. What does the bunker kind of symbolize, or what do you think the bunker symbolizes, either in terms of the relationship with the themes of the play, or it could also be like the relationship with the characters?
I mean, I think the bunker, and like, ladies jump in, because
yes.
I mean, I think the bunker symbolizes in some ways privilege. I mean, they're clearly privileged people. And I mean, I could be very wrong in saying that, like, not everyone has the luxury and means to be able to like build a quote unquote post-apocalyptic realm where, like, you know, you do have your somewhat your basic needs, though there's just mostly, it seems like there's just really alcohol. But yeah, I mean, they are very privileged people. And, you know, one of Kara's I think biggest things that she was bringing into the rehearsal room was like, you know, like the Rockefellers and these people who are, and like kind of have all this wealth. And they're also, there's like complicated family dynamics and a little bit like Succession, like, you know, like this father figure who we actually never meet or really, you know, we don't meet him, but his presence is there. But I, that's like my first initial reaction based on that question. But
I think that that's a great, I think privilege is a great word for it. I also think with privilege, there's a lot of fear. I think it's privilege and fear. It's fear of not existing in this way that they've always known and they feel really comfortable in because it is really comfortable for them. And fear of aging, fear of not being beautiful, fear of not being the center of attention, all of that, because they have, it's almost like they just create a physical manifestation of this very privileged bubble that they grew up in. And never wanting to break out of that or let anyone in also is the interesting thing is, well, somebody does come into the bunker, but really nobody else but them can enter. So it's interesting that it's also, you know, they're really excluding themselves from society and excluding everyone else.
I really liked how the kind of the acting kind of out of fear, out of almost precarity, comes up in this play. There's like this feeling when you're in a place of like very extreme privilege and comfortability, and yet there's such friction in your inability to really enjoy the comfortability because you're afraid of losing it. So every kind of move is like very, very fear-based. Would you say that any one of your characters like struggles or maybe is or like really kind of enjoying, or like how do they tackle like this sense that they're going to be here for eternity?
I think it's a lot of denial of them. We start the play at a point that, you know, something has just happened. The father figure has, it's not really a spoiler because it's revealed in the opening, but he's chosen to die. So this obviously calls into question why they're all there in the first place. And it's something that they haven't really ever had to confront. I think that they cope with it a lot by, obviously, they're just drinking a lot, they're partying, they're playing games, they're very surface level, they don't talk about ever leaving, it doesn't come up. And I think a lot of them have chosen to believe that the world has turned into a terrible place, and they did make a choice, and it's a lot of, you know, if they ever had to confront that reality, then they'd be miserable that they really, in many ways, have ruined their lives. So it's a lot of laughing through it and pushing down any sort of negative feelings that come up and just glossing right over them.
Yeah, these characters are not comfortable with talking about their emotions at all. So there's that constant conflict throughout this whole play of, well, how do we talk about things when we don't know how to? Or we've spent 50 years, well, we've been in the bunker for 50 years. So, yeah. I mean, how do we talk about things that we need to talk about that we're actually in this moment reckoning with, without the vocabulary or even the ability to perhaps even feel those things because they've been pushed down for so many years. So it definitely is interesting. And the characters that begin to turn a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It obviously creates a lot of conflict with those who are still stuck in the mud. Mm-hmm. But I'm in this question, I was thinking about how our visitor from the outside world that comes in after Angel sings Paper, she sings Paper Moon. And the visitor says, oh, well, nobody dresses like you anymore. Nobody, you know, listens to music like that anymore. And I respond with, was Daddy right? Did the world get worse? Mm-hmm. And I think that's just, mm-hmm. you know, I think that just explains the fear that he instilled in us that things are just going to get worse. So we're at the height of our wealth, of our privilege. Mm-hmm. Why don't we just all go down to the bunker and continue the party, essentially? Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're so, I think, loyal to him. He was able to sell it for us. And now, yeah, a lot of us have to question if that was the right decision.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, I think Violet and Lauren really hit all the points. But yeah, I mean, I think the fear also, I was thinking like, you know, the fear of maybe some of them, we don't know. I mean, one could argue we're hesitant initially at first, but there was fear of like disobeying this, you know, disobeying Daddy and like, oh, if you're a part of this family where everyone's like close knit, you know, there's a, my character is much, you know, kind of fluid, and is kissing everyone supposedly. So it's also, it's like also, what was my point with that though? My point with that is that there's a sense that no one is able to like think individually at first. Like it takes them time. Once they go to the bunker, and eventually, as Lauren said, some of these characters come to the realization faster than others, but it's like once the Daddy character is removed, who I do think is a source of fear for mm-hmm. us a bit, we're able to like kind of think independently, face our fears eventually, or some will not. And yeah, it's interesting to think about, but
mm-hmm. yeah, I was thinking that I like this idea of in this bunker space where ostensibly like nothing matters, continue the party and like live for eternity, there's still like stakes, there's still like high stakes,
yeah.
Because I think of maybe like a virtue of being, you know, a mortal like human is that you are like emotionally precarious, no matter the context. So there's always that feeling of like you could lose something, like your sense of self or individuality. And also I think you know, I like this kind of concept of like just isolation, and like anytime I've been like isolated in the space with anyone, you just become a different person almost. And I think the more you're isolated with people, the more you kind of learn about someone else, and someone else is like you know, maybe earthly facade almost, and kind of your own as well, for sure. Yeah, and I was wondering also, like, in your mind, what is sort of maybe the symbolic significance of the pool?
Ooh, yeah, well, okay. So the interesting thing about this, and I mean, I don't think this will spoil anything. I don't think that this would be a reason to not come to see the pool. But yeah, shocker, there is no pool. a real pool. It is a tarp. It is a blue tarp. We barely have anything in this bunker. There's a blue tarp. There is a bar cart. And we have games. We've created games. So when you're stripped down, it's a really interesting thing, because I think Violet in one rehearsal, she mentioned this, and please Violet, jump in if I'm not conveying this in the way that you did, but I thought it was so interesting. You said once that like, there's something about having everything, like being a wealthy person. And it's like, how much farther can you go? Like, if you have all the things, at what point are you like, okay, first of all, do any of these things really make me happy? Mm-hmm. And second of all, where's there to go from here? Like, there's only so far you can go. So I think it's really interesting what Kara did with, we have everything on the outside, but now we're in this bunker where we're all in here. We can't leave. There's just a blue tarp on the ground. There's a bar cart. There are some chairs. There's some lounge chairs, like, you know, that you would see on the side of a pool. And we do have some rooms down the hall, and we have alcohol. Mm-hmm. And my biggest question that I've really been thinking about and grappling with throughout rehearsal is, how did our father get us down here to now live in this?
Mm-hmm. In minimalism.
And to like be happy. And like my character, the amount of time she says throughout the play, I am happy. I am so happy. I am never sad. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's convincing herself of that. Mm-hmm. But like they're having a part. I mean, first of all, they're inebriated all the time. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I just think it's a really interesting thing that they've been stripped down to nothing, really, and they're so convinced that this is the way they're going to spend the rest of eternity, because they are young and they are beautiful, and they have this status about them. And there's a point in the play where the outside guest even says to me, you don't even have a real pool, which I've heard in recent rehearsals, like, what a break in reality. Like, I would almost like connect it to being in somewhat of like a cult. Mm-hmm. And like someone from the outside were to say something to me where I'd be like, wait, it's not a real pool. What am I doing? You know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if either of you want to comment on any of that, but yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think Kara, just there's so much symbolism, and like there's just a lot, I would say, happening. But it feels very simplistic on like the base level, in the sense of like what's actually happening. But there's like so much behind before, you know, sometimes you see a play and like all the action's happening on stage, and that's what's happening with us. But there's also like just like so much history that we've all kind of had to, you know, co-generate and create for ourselves too, so that we can, like, you know, the stakes are there, like the environment makes sense for us, like we're all on the same page as characters and actors, which has been kind of like, it's been interesting, and it's been really kind of fun and playful in that way. Yeah, it's funny for I can't relate to these people in like the real world sense at all, but it's interesting to, you know, for a family to have so much and then make the choice to have nothing. And it's almost like, to me, it's like they were too scared to lose it in the first place, so it was better for them to like make the choice. Mm-hmm. And they were too scared of influence or the outside world being like, you're actually not that important. Mm-hmm. There's another family that is better than you all. Your parties aren't that great. You know, and and for them to feel maybe a sense, for maybe daddy to feel like a sense of insecurity and like wanting to like maintain this nucleus for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm. We all call him daddy throughout, which is kind of an interesting thing, even if
that is, yeah,
they call it angel, like that's not their father. Mm-hmm. And yet his name to all of us is daddy, which brings up kind of that, which we discussed a little bit in rehearsals, that kind of cult leader yeah. vibe a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I just wanted to say, because Elida, you just put me back on track to your original question, which was what does the pool symbolize? And I think, I mean, you know, fountain of youth, water, mm-hmm. I think purity, this thing that we're wanting to preserve, and the fact that it's really just a thin piece of tarp and it's not going to last either. Things are going to break mm-hmm. down. I mean, I say at one point it's going to flake away. There's not going to be anything here, mm-hmm. But I'll always remember the pool. Mm-hmm. I think that's totally on purpose, whether maybe Kara meant to do that or not. There's a connection to the need to live in this beautiful young body forever, and be around this pool that perhaps is feeding that and nourishing that, but not even a real pool. Mm-hmm. So what is this? What is any of this?
And the way that they interact with the pool is very childlike. So it's very mm-hmm. interesting to mention Fountain of Youth, because that's never really explicitly said, but just their interactions with it do kind of represent this regression, like repetitiveness, like a need to be young forever. Of course, none of them are children when they freeze themselves, but they act like children in many yeah. ways.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, to me, it also represents like childhood and like mm-hmm. child activities and playfulness. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, in the most like simplest terms, to me, when I think about a pool, like a pool is a status symbol. Mm-hmm. I always think about like, I don't know, when you're a kind of coming of age and you think about the future, you know, when I was a kid, I always thought like, oh, people who have pools are rich, or like they're able to have this thing that, you know, requires so much maintenance. And then as you get older, you kind of realize, oh, people don't really use their pools, and they don't really appreciate their pools. And I've just so many people I've babysat for, they have like beautiful pools and they totally. Never use them. Yeah, or they have like gates around them, and it's very, very interesting, because like, yeah, because it's just like this concept of it's like this very lavish thing that you have, and it's a privilege to like have huge yeah. expensive things, you know, that you're able to afford not to care about them, or to just sure. be desensitized from reality a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The amount of people I can think of like in my real life who have pools, and I like, what do you mean you don't use them? I'm mm-hmm. like, why don't you swim? If I had a pool, I would be in it all summer long. But yeah, it's true. That's an interesting insight mm-hmm. for sure.
Yeah. And I also love kind of this, you know, feeling of like the pool is not real. Like, you know, nothing is really like what is real. And I just like that. Sometimes I'd love characters that live in their own kind of concept of what reality is, and have their own very huge distorted system of values. I remember like there's a lot of people like I've met in my life who are like, I worked for this one person, and like they told me like, oh, if you don't want to work here, like there are other companies you can just go and work for. And I was thinking like, how can you say that? Like, ooh. It's hard to get a job.
Yeah,
like,
exactly. Yeah, that's rude.
It's not like I can go to the job store and like
yeah, pick out, exactly. right.
You know, But in terms of like the action and the plot, how would you describe how like the sequence of events kind of escalates during the play?
I mean, the sequence of events escalate, and we don't want to give too much away, but mm-hmm. like keep referencing the surprise visitor, and she really kind of she literally challenges us, whether we like it or not, to face death and to face our fears, and that like just quickly that quickly escalates. And then, you know, my character, she used to, you know, they used to be lovers. Mm-hmm. And so I also think my character kind of starts to wean off the whole family agreeance, like, okay, like, I'm not sure I'm in this, I don't want to be a part of this game anymore. And I think that it's as a result, really, I would say, of this other character coming in and really shaking things up. Mm-hmm. And we try to control her, but we're not able to. And mm-hmm. I think like her words and her insight starts to get to us. Mm-hmm. Again, like at different times, different points in the piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think what we've really been discovering is that we've gotten to the point in rehearsals where we have run the play. Mm-hmm. And that mm-hmm. was eye-opening for me to see how quickly things escalate. Mm-hmm. And it kind of changed how I think of my character and her journey a little bit. I think for her, a lot of the escalation starts at the very beginning with Daddy choosing to die. Mm-hmm. I think that the surprise visitor just really escalates everything by so much, but mm-hmm. I would say the stakes immediately are very high. Mm-hmm. They're not really acting like it, but there's definitely a lot of inner turmoil happening for some of these characters who have never had to think about death. Mm-hmm. I think at one point Bunny says, now we don't have to think about death anymore. So this has been mm-hmm. on their mind, never something that they've ever had to think about. Mm-hmm. So from there, I think it escalates so fast in a really exciting way. And yeah, the surprise visitor definitely throws a huge wrench in things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was almost thinking kind of on the note of like the surrealism. It's sort of almost not exactly the same, but it sort of reminded me of like a No Exit, like Sartrean kind of situation. I mean, all these characters in the pool, like they want to be there and they live for, but it's like this concept of, you know, really realizing things once you're at like this eternity, like intellectualizing and like being conscious of eternity. To me, that's very scary.
Sure.
Like I'd rather just like pass away and like disintegrate into like atoms or whatever, go to heaven or whatever have you. But I think to me it's an interesting idea, because if I were to the concept of living forever or eternity, it seems like to me, I'm like, that's a concept of hell. Like, mm-hmm. and then I'm thinking like, well, I'm like, oh, it reminds me of No Exit. Then you're like, hell is other people. And like, I don't know, but I think it's just sort of like, no matter where you are, the thing that really lives forever truly is like the innate flaws you have as a person. And that the people are very fallible. And yeah, no, I do also really like the minimalism aspect, because I always also like think of rich people who like are on top of the world and they like control government control, but their like homes and houses are very bunker like, you know, I always think of like you know, Kanye West's or like Rick Owens or something, like, you know, like sure. really just kind of like this like people who have like so much, and yet aesthetically it's sort of this this weird you know, yearning for nothingness. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very, very, very interesting. So what is like, what would you say, like, how has the rehearsal process been for this? Super practical, or in terms of like the style of like building and the rehearsal process, has it been just like very like discovery led? Do you guys like all do your own thing and like kind of lock things in as you rehearse?
Yeah, so it's been a pretty quick process, as you know, all, you know, low budget DIY theater is, you know, you really kind of have to jump right in. You only have a few weeks to get a whole play up on its feet with many different schedules in play. So yeah, we've pretty much immediately jumped right up on our feet with the scripts in hand, and just discovering moment to moment, doing moment to moment work. I like working with Kara because she's talked a lot about, you know, this is a very abstract mm-hmm. concept, right? And what she's written on the page and what's within the subtext is really what she would like us to focus on and work through mm-hmm. in the room during rehearsal. So, I mean, my way of moving through rehearsal is a lot of, like personally, it tends to be a lot of world building and kind of figuring out a character's whole life outside of what she's saying and what the play is. So I've been doing that work kind of on the side. And when we come into rehearsal, it's really moment to moment work. Mm-hmm. Because it's so active in this controlled space and yeah. everything's happening in real time. There isn't too much reference to the outside.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. It's very active in the moment, especially mm-hmm. with who just died and who's coming in that's new. Mm-hmm. So it's actually, I don't know if you're familiar with Meisner at all, but it's mm-hmm. actually this, a lot of the scenes, I'm like, this is like perfect dialogue for Meisner exercises mm-hmm. because you can put them on loop and it's all about reacting to the person in front of you. Mm-hmm. And the words are the vehicle for that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. I mean, and what's been, we just, I think Violet mentioned, we just did like our first run through, which was like, whoa, because we've been rehearsing also based on everyone's schedules and lives like out of order. And so then when we actually jumped on our feet and then did it from beginning, middle and end, we're all like, oh, okay. Like it's, and I think we're going to be doing more of that until we mm-hmm. open. Just keep running the play. And because sometimes it's one of those pieces where you're like, not what happens next mm-hmm. as the actor, but you're like, there's sometimes you're like, oh, wait, like what, where are we a little bit? Because it's yes. so, as Lauren was saying, very, very present. We don't really, and a lot of that segues into the next is like literally like refilling drinks. Mm-hmm. And what game are we doing now? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how my brain is like kind of like mapping this out a bit too. But yeah, I mean, very, very quick. And like Kara's pretty pretty open, I would say, in like just kind of letting us play and try things. And she's always, I feel like she's been very supportive in that way, which is always lovely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this coming week of rehearsal and the following week, which is also the week that we open, I believe.
Woohoo!
I think that we've done a lot of moment-to-moment work. We have the play fully staged, and now is kind of an exciting time where I think, like Lauren was saying, it's a lot of going home, doing the work yourself, and thinking about your character, thinking about their arc. And now we're going to get to the point where we really get to see what everyone has been doing. And we're going to really see the arcs come to life. And I think we're going to discover so, so much. And the work has been really fun and great so far. And I think there's so much we can still learn. And I'm really excited to get the scripts out of our hands and to just do it and see what happens, what changes, what we are learning.
Yeah, that's like kind of the best part of like running through a play, like front to back first time, because when you do like rehearsals in these little chunks, they're almost kind of like little stories that live independently. And like, it's so fun to like see what like other people have been working on. And then you run the whole play together. And even though you kind of know when you're rehearsing what happened before, what's happening after, you know it in your mind's eye, but then when you see it, you're like, oh, like, and it like opens up like the next, like takes things to the next level, and like makes everyone's like individual performances so much more like powerful, like brings everything together. Where is the space like that this is going to be? Where is it located?
It's at the attic, at the Tank, which is in Midtown.
Cool.
Which I told a friend of mine that today, and she was like, oh my goodness, this is like the first time in forever I've seen a play in Manhattan. They're usually always in Brooklyn. At least the circles that we run in, usually shows are in Brooklyn. So yeah, so it'll be.
I love that. So the Tank, do they have, I've seen one play at the Tank. Do they have just that one space? Do they have multiple spaces?
They have multiple spaces.
Okay, cool. But
I think the attic is gonna, I don't know if you saw a show in there. I think it's gonna be, it's long from my understanding. So I think that's gonna be really great for our environment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It's very a good cool.
space. And then when do you like, are you like moving in there the second like week of run throughs or?
We have one day in there.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Perfect.
That was officially clarified because, you know, we have locking that Kara's instilled in the piece. And so we've been, you know, doing it in varying locations, albeit like a small, you know, Kara's apartment, to doing it at like CPR in Bushwick, which is a little bit bigger and roughly around the same size. But yeah, we're really gonna be like all hands on deck that one day.
Nice. That's a benefit of having like minimalistic kind of setting.
Sure.
Yeah. So cool. Well, I think we lost our,
oh,
our
her third... computer died. She's coming back in a minute.
Okay. Cool. Well, I'll wait for her so we can kind of plug everybody.
Thank you.
But where have you been rehearsing?
So either at Kara's apartment or at a Center for Performance Research. We were in the Tank, not in the space we're going to be performing in, but in a rehearsal room there. And I think, I don't know if we have any more rehearsals there, actually. We were supposed to go on Friday, but because Kara lives in Brooklyn, Elida lives in Brooklyn, Susan lives in Brooklyn, we just had too many people coming in and it would have been really, really difficult to get to rehearsal.
Yeah.
I also just want to mention our two other actors who are not on this call.
Right.
Susan O'Doherty is playing Lucy. And Samuel Vita is playing Junior.
Perfect.
Yes, well, we don't want to talk about them. They're awesome too.
Yes,
yeah, they're great.
Definitely. Well, you know what's funny? The thing I find, like, whenever I do apartment rehearsals, I always get so worried about knocking things over. Just like when you're in a small apartment, that's always something I think about, just like stepping over people's stuff. But I guess that's always what makes it like fun and exciting as well. But yeah, cool. So You guys got a couple weeks to go. What are the performance dates?
October 12th, 14th, and 15th at 8 p.m.
Perfect.
Amazing. At the Tank.
Also, some of us are like doing multiple shows at once, which I've never, that's never really happened, I think, in my experience. So it's been like a little, some of us are like now just finishing other shows or actually starting rehearsals for another show while doing the show. So so all the dates blend in at some point.
Yeah, I never thought of that actually, because like you kind of forget that like people do like multiple stuff at one time. And then where can we find all of you? I guess on Instagram or otherwise.
Yeah, on Instagram. If you type my long name into Instagram, it will come up. But my Instagram name is La La Lola.
Amazing.
Mine is just Violet Savage, my name.
Mine is Kaleidoscopes, but spelt with my first name.
Amazing. Cool. And then where can we get tickets?
The link is probably in all of our bios.
Yeah, perfect. Yes.
Amazing.
It's an Eventbrite link.
Cool. Awesome. Well, I'm super excited for you guys. I'm really like, when I read the play, I was like, wow, it almost feels to me like they're there for eternity. But to me, I'm like, well, maybe that's why I was like, this feels like purgatory on a psychological level almost.
Absolutely. Totally.
Like, almost like they're like dying, but they don't know. And they're like in purgatory. That's something that was on my mind. But anyways, I'm super excited for all of you guys and wish you the best of luck and end scene.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yes, of course.
Nice to meet you too.
Nice to meet you.
So nice to meet you.
Bye guys.
Bye.
We'll chat tomorrow.